televised display of his drawings had been a hammer blow. As he sat in his office, peering into the depths of his computer, James Cattar would turn every time he heard footsteps in the hallway. He was waiting for the police. The same night that he'd seen the drawings on television, he'd driven himself in a panic to a Comp USA, where he bought a package of zip disks and a new hard drive. At his office, he locked the door, dumped all of his lectures to the new zips, then stripped the hard drive out of his computer. He also dug out every zip disk in the place, except those he bought that morning, and put them in his briefcase with the old hard drive. He took an hour fussing with Windows, reinstalling it on the new drive, then began the task of reading his lecture files back in. At home, he smashed the old hard drive, extracted the disks, and cut them to pieces with metal shears. He put all the pieces in a sack, drove south down the Mississippi, found a private spot, and tossed the sack into the viscous brown water. That was that. Let the cops come now, he'd thought. They'd find nothing but a pristine drive and the usual academic software. No Photoshop, no photo files. The cops never came. Cattar stayed off the porn websites, put away his drawing instruments. An overdue tidying up, a good time to lie low, and perhaps do a little maintenance on his career. A new book, perhaps. He bought a notebook and made some notes. The one fly in this intellectual ointment was Barstad. She kept calling. He'd destroyed all the images of her, but his mind kept going to her. The imp of the perverse. Isn't that what Poe called it? The irrepressible impulse to do harm to oneself. He had put off another meeting with her. His drawings continued to come up on the television. But after a day went by and no cops came, he began to feel safe. Nobody knew. If he were careful, he thought, he could begin working again. He began by making another trip to a Comp USA, where he bought a cheap laptop. That night, he walked down the hall to Charlotte Newman's office and slipped the door lock with a butter knife. All the locks could be done the same way. The professors knew it, as did the brighter undergraduates. Newman's office was a simple cube with a bookcase along one wall. Her copy of Photoshop 6 was in the top left corner, and he lifted it off the shelf. The installation took no time at all. In an hour, he was walking out of the building. He had known Rinkowski Hall all of his life, all the nooks and crannies and hiding places. He would hide the computer after each day's work, he thought, and never again contaminate his daily work. But the next day brought bigger trouble. A dirty day, a grinding, bitter drizzle pounding down. Late in the afternoon, he'd gone down to Newman's office. Newman's door was open, and she was sitting at her desk. He knocked on the doorframe. Charlotte, She heard his voice and turned her head, and her arm spasmodically jerked across her desk away from him. Her hand held a slip of blue paper. Her face was locked with sudden conscious control, which produced a weak smile. He continued without a break. A prerequisite waiver I don't seem to have anymore. Of course, let me see. She casually opened a drawer, slipped her hand in, riffled some papers and said, where did I put those? When her hand emerged, there was no paper in it. She opened the next drawer down and said, ah, here, and handed him a half dozen slips. He left the office. What was she hiding from him? Why did that slip of paper stick in his mind like a thorn? At 7 o'clock that night, he went back to Newman's with his butter knife and a flashlight. Her desk was unlocked, and he opened the drawers and looked inside. No blue paper. Checked her bulletin board, found nothing blue. Damn it! He let himself out of the office and walked down to his own, turned on a study light, swiveled his chair so that his face was in shadow, and closed his eyes. He knew that blue. He might have dozed for a few minutes. When he opened his eyes again, they wandered, almost by their own accord, to the bottom drawer of an old wooden file cabinet. He dropped to his knees and pulled the drawer out. A half dozen fat files were stuffed with paper. He riffled through them, and the label Planes on Planes caught his eye. Notes, letters, comments on his cubism book. He pulled it, opened it, and saw the blue. He slipped it out and recognized it instantly. Jesus! 4 years old and somehow she'd remembered. An invitation to a publication party for Planes on Planes. The publisher hadn't been willing to pay for much of anything, so he'd done the party invitations himself. He'd done a quick little self-portrait for the front page of the blue invitation. The drawing looked nothing like the drawings on television, really. But his historian's eye felt the resemblance. Something in the technique and the choice of line. Newman was a historian herself. Guitar closed his eyes, overcome by the image of Newman taking the paper to the police. They were that close. Had she talked to anyone? Maybe not. Sooner or later, though. She's gotta go, he mumbled. Right away. Tonight. He walked straight out of his office, down the stairs, and out to his car. He'd been to her house twice, and it wasn't far away. Just across the river, and a little north and east. He drove over. He was cruising her house when he saw the lights come on in the garage. He pulled to the side and let her pass, then fell in behind. They drove together to a supermarket. She got out and hurried into the store. She should be heading back home fairly quickly, he thought. Nobody buys groceries and then goes on to a movie. He wheeled the car in a circle and drove back to her house. He parked a block down, turned up the collar on his raincoat, and got out. He saw not a single person along the sidewalk. Newman's house was one of the pre-war clapboard places. The garage sat to one side, originally detached, but now connected to the house with a breezeway. Guitar turned smartly at the front walk, climbed the stoop, and rang the doorbell. Nobody answered. He pulled open the storm door and tried the doorknob. Locked. He hurried back down the steps and tried the breezeway door. Locked. He continued around to the side of the garage. The next house was only 20 feet away, but a hedge ran between them. He walked down the length of the garage. Now he was in arrest territory. The garage had a back door. Locked. Cautious bitch, he thought. The breezeway also had a back door, and it was locked. The back of the house had a two-step wooden deck. He climbed the deck, tried the door. Locked. A double window looked out over the deck. He walked over and found a crack in the armor. The window was positioned over the kitchen sink. It was cranked open about an inch. He grabbed the edge of the window and pushed it back and forth. It gave a bit more. In 2 minutes, he'd managed to work it open far enough that he could reach inside to the crank and crank it all the way open. He boosted himself into the window opening, clambered awkwardly across the sink, and stepped on a dish full of water when he dropped to the floor. The dog? He stopped to listen. Heard nothing but the hum of the furnace. Then a furtive sound to his right. He whirled and saw the cat, a gray-striped tiger. The cat took a quick look at him and sprinted for some other part of the house. As he suspected, he was leaving puddles of water and muddy footprints on the floor. He spotted a paper towel rack, rolled off a few feet of toweling, wadded it up, dropped it on the floor, and used his feet to push it around like a mop. When both his shoes and the floor were dry, he stuffed the dirty towels into his pocket. A box of garbage bags sat on the kitchen counter. He took one, turned off the light, and headed for the garage. After all that, the killing was simple, as it always had been. He found a spade in the garage and walked back into the breezeway. He waited in the dark for nearly 20 minutes, thinking about not much at all, when Newman's car pulled into the driveway and the garage door started up. Qatar heard the garage door start down again. The car engine died. The car door opened, then closed. He lifted the spade. Then another car door opened, and he nearly panicked. She'd picked somebody up. Wait. She's getting the grocery bags out of the back seat. A moment later, the door to the garage opened, and Newman stepped inside. He swung as though he were chopping wood, and the back of the spade hit her on the forehead, crushing her skull like a cantaloupe. Newman went down with a soggy thump. The bag of groceries she'd been carrying around spilled around her with major brand color. Campbell's soup, Nabisco crackers, Swanson TV dinners, Tampax. Qatar moved quickly now. There wasn't much blood, but there was some. Before it could trickle onto the floor, he lifted her head and fitted it into the garbage bag, then slipped the bag down the rest of her body. The body went into the trunk of her car with the spade. He went quickly back into the house, got another garbage bag, filled it with the groceries. Now. Out. But just a minute. He could take a few seconds to look around. She talked all the time about her dead husband, letting you know about how well off they'd been. There might be something here in the house. In her bedroom, he found three rings, a pair of earrings and a necklace. They positively thumped with authenticity. These would be worth a few dollars. When he finished looking through the house, he thought himself perhaps $15,000 richer. A dream, he thought, to get so much by accident. The dream quickly turned into a nightmare when he left for his disposal place. Getting into the countryside was easy enough. Getting the body into the ground would be another problem, he thought, with the rain and cold. The leaves would be slippery, and the slope was steep. Although he'd enjoy the time on the hillside, there with his other friends. All the friends of James Qatar gathered in the dark under the oak trees. But when he crossed the creek and turned the corner, he was caught in a sudden blaze of light. There was no place to turn. They were right by his hill. What were they doing? Police in the rain. A car accident? As he crept up on the scene, a cop stepped into the road and waved him along. Qatar slowly moved past. He saw the men working on the hillside. Saw a shovel. Saw three TV vans. He was more stunned than panicked. They'd found his special place after all. With his mind moving like mud, he wandered down a series of narrow blacktop tracks. The body in the back seemed to glow in the dark. Had to get rid of her. Had to. That, it turned out, was as simple as the killing. He cut onto I-494 south of St. Paul and took it back west, eventually finding his way to the Ford Bridge over the Mississippi. He parked at the end of the bridge, looked both ways, then carried the garbage sack out over the water and dumped the body into the Mississippi. He started to let the bag go with it, but caught it at the last minute. It was too dark to see the body hit, but it would soon be going over the dam. And on the way back to Newman's car, he'd realized what he'd done. He'd faked a suicide. She was certainly moody enough, dark enough, lonely. Perhaps he could help the idea along. He drove Newman's car back to his own, took the groceries out, along with the spade, put them in the trunk of his car, then drove the car back to the bridge and left it parked illegally on Mississippi Boulevard. Then he started walking. 4 miles to his own car in the rain. But he needed the time to think. Life was becoming complicated. He'd now done something he'd always carefully avoided in the past. He'd killed somebody close to himself. The cops could stand in her office doorway and see his. As he walked back, he began to weep again. Life was cruel. Unfair. A man like himself. James Qatar walked along, snuffling in the dark and the rain. And he thought about the friends of James Qatar. Before tonight, snugly buried on the hillside above the creek. Released now. He wondered if they would come to see him. Lucas got up early, kissed Weather goodbye, and went to the telephone. The police in New Richmond knew the dentist used by Nancy Vanderpost, and the cop who answered the phone volunteered to run across the street to see if he had x-rays of her fillings. Next he called Marcy. Dell had suggested that there might be something special or peculiar about the drawings that were publicly posted rather than mailed to the victim. Lucas told Marcy to get somebody prying into Beverly Woods' history. The killer, he thought, was back there somewhere. While he was talking, got a beep of an incoming call. The New Richmond cop was calling from the dentist's office. The dentist had x-rays and was offering to scan and email them immediately. Lucas gave the dentist his email address, then called Larry Lake's cell phone. Lake answered, "McGrady decided last night that he wanted one more scan across the bottom of the hill. We think we found another grave, a seventh one, so we're doing another strip."
Jesus.
"Okay, see you in a bit." Lucas called Rosemarie. "We've got a seventh grave."
"Oh, boy. I'll tell you, the governor called first thing this morning. He wants a federal, state, local task force working on it. I suggested that he set up a federal, state task force to examine the forensic evidence and to coordinate between the local agencies."
"Tell me what that means."
"It means that we stay independent, but we send Xeroxes of everything to the task force, if there is a task force. But if there is a task force, it probably won't get started for a few days. So if we really want to look good, we take the guy before that."
Lucas cranked up his IBM and looked at his email. He found a message from a Doc John. He opened it and sent the images to his laser printer, and 2 minutes later had 8 life-sized X-ray pictures. The weather was better, still overcast but dry. Dell was waiting in front of his house. His wife waited with him, and when she saw the Tahoe coming, handed Dell a cooler. Cheryl said to Lucas, "Have Dell tell you about his cholesterol." On the way out of town, Lucas asked, "What's in the cooler?"
"Mostly cut carrots."
"So you're going to tell me about your cholesterol?"
Dell shrugged. "It's been stuck at 255. The doc wants it down under 200, and if I can't do it by diet, he's going to put me on lapivorin."
"Uh-oh. Isn't that what?"
"Yeah, the guy who comes backwards."
"So eat carrots."
Dell cracked a grin. "I'm going to love getting old."
At the graveyard site, there were now a half dozen TV trucks, along with the line of county sheriff's cars, state cars, a car with federal government tags, Marshall's Jeep, Lake Subaru, and a few more. A simple cop convention yesterday, now it's a full-scale clusterfuck, Dell said.
Lucas and Dell walked up the hill to the command tent. McGrady was still at work, but he looked beat. He peered over his glasses at Lucas.
"You're pretty chipper."
"Good night's sleep, pancakes for breakfast, nice conversation with a pretty woman.
Better than this, huh?"
Lucas nodded.
"You've got 7?
"Yeah."
"I got some X-ray printouts for you. This is for the woman from New Richmond, Nancy Vanderpost."
McGrady looked at them for a long moment, then said,
4.
"What?"
"They could be number 4.
He walked across the tent to 6 long cardboard boxes. Inside each box was a stack of clear plastic bags, with the contents of each bag carefully tagged. He rummaged around in box number 4 and came up with the bag. Inside, Lucas saw a lower jaw. McGrady looked at the jawbone for a minute, then at Lucas's printouts.
"Hello, Nancy."
Lucas called Marcy and told her about Vanderpost, and told her to start building a file with the cops from New Richmond. She said she would and added, "Black was over at the Archdiocese, and they're looking for a priest who studied art at UW-Stout in Menominee, but this Monsignor over there said they won't find one."
That was thin anyway.
"Yeah, but listen to this. After Black talked to the guy, he noticed that a bunch of these women listed going to Mass as one of their social activities, and he started to add them up. Of the 17 people who've gotten drawings so far, 11 are Catholic. That's way too many. Of the 3 dead women we know about, 2 were Catholic." When he got off the phone, Lucas asked McGrady if he'd seen Marshall.
"He wanders around the hill. He was right up on top the last time I saw him, sitting on a log."
He was still sitting on the log when Lucas climbed to the top of the hill.
Marshall said, "More bad news."
"Not a question."
"McGrady says 4 is Nancy Vanderpost from New Richmond."
"Ah, oh, jeez.
You did a hell of a job, man."
"I was nuts for all those years. That's the answer. I kept hoping she'd show up. You'd see those TV shows on amnesia. I knew it was all bullshit, that she was dead."
"You had the guy figured, and that's..."
"What the heck is this?"
Marshall was looking past Lucas down the hill. Dell was climbing toward them at a dead run.
"What?"
Lucas asked.
"They found another grave."
They were standing around hole 8, looking at a shoe with a dirty bone in it. Below, another federal car parked, and 3 men climbed out.
Bailey, Dell said.
Lucas looked down the hill. Bailey was the FBI's agent in charge at the Minneapolis office, a heavyset man who played a mean game of handball. Better go get him, take him up to the command tent, Lucas told Dell. I'll round up Marshall and McGrady. Bailey shook hands and Lucas said, 8's coming out of the ground now. This is Terry Marshall, a deputy sheriff from Dunn County over in Wisconsin. He broke it, Lucas explained. Bailey nodded at the marshal and said, Nice piece of work. I'm sorry about your niece.
I just hope we get the guy. If he reads the newspapers, he might have taken off.
Got nowhere to run, Bailey said. We've got enough bodies now that we should be able to pinpoint him with victim histories.
Could be tougher than that, Lucas said. We've been doing histories on all the women who got the drawings, and so far we've pretty much come up with zip.
We're setting up a task force. We'll have all the manpower we need. I talked to the director this morning, and he made this the number one priority nationwide. Nothing else comes first.
Lucas and Dell left the site 20 minutes later. Back at City Hall, Lucas spoke briefly with Rose Marie, filling her in, then suggested that Marcy be made liaison with the joint task force.
Give her a little exposure, Lucas said.
Rose Marie got Marcy on the phone, told her to stop down, and when she did, Rose Marie said,
You've been unanimously elected as our representative to the joint federal-state task force that's being set up.
Marcy nodded. Thanks, I'll do it. Anything else?
Go with God.
Out in the hall, Marcy said, If you fix this, I appreciate it. Lucas opened his mouth to reply, but she held up a finger. You're gonna crack wise, but you don't have to. I appreciate it, period.
Lucas shrugged.
So all right. If you're gonna spend all your time running around town, why don't you figure out why we're up to our ass in Catholics?
Maybe I'll do that.
The Aronson team had been compiling names and addresses and cross-checking them. Out of a couple thousand names, they'd found 44 matches and were trying to check the matches.
The problem is there's only one person who comes up more than twice, and that's Helen Cattar, who runs the Wells Museum over at St. Pat's. She comes up 4 times.
Catholic school, Lucas said.
Helen Cattar's a semi-sedentary 65, Black said. She couldn't strangle a fucking gerbil, even if she could catch one.
Still a whole bunch of Catholics.
And guess what? The guy directing the investigation for the city of Minneapolis is a Catholic.
Lapsed Catholic.
As Lucas looked through the sets of matches, he saw nothing that looked like a pattern. Who talked to Helen Cattar?
I did.
Show her the pictures?
A couple. She didn't recognize the style. She's pretty old. I didn't roll out any of the vaginal extravaganzas.
She's in art and she's named 4 times, and she's a Catholic.
You want me to talk to her again?
Nope. I'll go talk to her.
Get me out into town.
St. Patrick's University was on the south side of Minneapolis, south of the Lake Street Bridge along the Mississippi, and directly across the river from St. Thomas, its bitter intellectual, political, and athletic rival. 20 buildings sprawled along the west bank of the river. Like most of the other buildings on campus, the Wells was red brick. Helen Cattar's office was at the far end of the building. A heavyset secretary was reading a newspaper when Lucas stepped inside. She looked up.
Are you Mike?
No, I'm Lucas. I'm a police officer. I was hoping to speak with Ms. Cattar.
That would be Mrs. Cattar.
The secretary leaned toward an old-fashioned intercom, pushed a button.
Mrs. Cattar, there's a cop here to see you.
Is he good-looking?
He looks like he probably cleans up pretty good, but he also looks like he's got a mean streak.
Sounds interesting. Send him in.
Inside, Helen Cattar was also reading a newspaper. She had once been a very pretty blonde, Lucas thought, but her fine skin was now a dense map of tiny wrinkles.
You're Lucas Davenport.
Yes.
I talked to that nice gay man you sent over earlier. Is this about the same topic?
Lucas frowned.
Black told you he was gay?
No, no.
I surmised it.
Is he still in the closet?
Technically, everybody knows nobody mentions it. Makes life easier.
Ah, well. Is there something else I can help you with?
I can't say, really. Black explained all this about the drawings to you, and if you've been reading the paper, you know about the burial ground down in Goodhue County.
It's appalling.
We believe the drawings and the killings are connected. We think that the killer has some special relationship with Catholics. We have one witness who might have actually met him, who said that he may be a priest. And this was without knowing that an unusual number of these victims were Catholic.
Why would a priest kill Catholics?
Well, it could be something very simple. Perhaps the overwhelming number of people he meets are Catholics. But we don't know that he's a priest. There's just one guy saying that. Anyway, we're interviewing people who got the drawings, and we're researching the pasts of all the people who were killed. We're looking at address books and Christmas cards and everything we can find. Your name has come up 4 times. A lot of other names have come up twice, but you're the only 4-time winner. So you have something in common with the killer.
Good Lord.
Yeah, I'm sorry to put it that way, but there it is.
But it may be something simple, like you said with the priest and the idea of killing Catholics. I'm a Catholic, and I know a lot of Catholics because of this school, so that's probably why I came up 4 times.
Probably. But there might be some other connection. I was hoping you could mull it over and see if you could come up with something.
Do you think he's connected to the university?
We have no idea. None of the murdered women were, of the ones we've identified. Since you came up 4 times, and you're at an art museum, and he's an artist, apparently, although he may also be a photographer. Lucas took a card out of his card case and handed it to her. You will think about it?
Absolutely.
Lucas turned to go, then said, Black showed you the drawings. Did he show you a picture of the Aronson girl? She was not one of the Catholics, but she was from here in Minneapolis. She disappeared 1.5 years ago.
No, I only saw a couple of the drawings. Not the good ones, from what they say in the paper.
Lucas dug through the file, found the Aronson photo, and passed it across the desk. Mrs. Kattar peered at Aronson's photo.
I don't think I know her.
She handed the photo back.
Long shot.
Lucas was putting it back when he saw the Xeroxes of the Laura Winton photos. He fished a couple of them out. How about these? It's possible that the killer took them himself.
After a minute, she said, No, I don't recall ever seeing her, but...
What?
This background here.
She had a finger on the rock wall in the background of the last of the photos. I thought it looked like it was along the river, Lucas said. Here in town.
I think it is. You know that big bronze statue of St. Patrick squashing a St. Thomas quarterback?
I thought it was a snake.
Could be. They're easily mistaken. Anyway, I think the end of this wall here is the beginning of the semicircular wall that goes out around the statue.
Really? You think?
Helen Kattar walked with Lucas down to the river.
There. Lucas said to Mrs. Kattar, that little stack of rocks at the end of the wall.
You were right. I can't see what possible good it will do.
We have all these Catholics, and now we've got a location. I don't know if he's associated with the college, or if he just lives around here, but for some reason, they were here. You can almost see his shadow.
An unusual thought for a policeman. It could lead to poetry, or to country and western.
God forbid, Lucas said, smiling at her. I can almost see the guy. One of the first women he killed said he looked like a movie star in an old movie, Day of the Jackal, about an attempted assassination of De Gaulle. The killer looked like the Jackal.
I'll have to rent the movie. You say it's old?
60s or 70s.
Ah, I spent the 50s and 60s watching art films. They were very bad.
Lucas laughed. At the corner of the Wells, Lucas said goodbye and started toward his car. Mrs. Kattar called after him.
Mr. Davenport?
Lucas turned.
I'm sure this has nothing to do with your case, but a professor in the art history department just committed suicide, yesterday or the night before.
That's interesting. What was his name?
It was a her.
Oh. Not what he wanted. A suicide?
She apparently jumped off the Ford Bridge. The St. Paul paper had an article that said the body's condition suggested that she went over the dam.
Did the story say anything about depression? Lucas asked.
Nothing like that. My son works in the department, and he said that she was troubled. Quite unpopular. I don't know if that leads to suicide.
I'll tell you something, Mrs. Kattar. For depressives, nothing can lead to suicide.
Lucas walked back to the truck and then took out his cell phone. He called St. Paul Homicide. A detective named Allport answered.
I hope to hell this is a social call. I see you're working that graveyard case.
Yeah, but I came across a really obscure connection. The last woman killed, Aronson, was over at St. Pat's just a few days before, maybe with the killer. We think the killer's an artist.
I saw the drawings, and this chick who went off the bridge taught art at St. Pat's.
Yeah.
We got nothing on it, Lucas. She went through a meat grinder under that dam. We kind of think that a massive blow to the head did the first real damage. Looks like she hit a piece of abutment head first when she went over. We looked through her house, we looked through her car, no blood, no signs of a struggle, no nothing. We talked to a couple of people in her department who said she was angry, confrontational, and maybe depressed, and maybe an unfulfilled lesbo, so...
No sign that she was strangled?
Nah, she wasn't strangled. Where are you at?
Over by St. Pat's.
You aren't more than 10 minutes from her house then. Run across the Lake Street Bridge. She's practically right there.
How do I get in?
He had to wait in the driveway for 5 minutes before the squad car showed. The patrol cop gave him the keys and Lucas let himself inside. Her car was in the garage. He snapped on an overhead light, opened the door, and looked inside. The back seat was littered with old newspapers, memos, and empty Diet Coke bottles. A couple of cash register slips lay on the passenger side floor, and he picked them up. One came from a Kinko's, the other from a supermarket. $40 worth of groceries, cat litter, Tampax, and light bulbs. At the bottom were the date and time. 10 o'clock on the night she apparently died. Lucas carried the slip back to the house and looked in the refrigerator and cupboards. Found a box of cat litter almost empty. Found a box of Tampax almost empty. He went back to the car and popped the trunk. No groceries. He called Allport.
I was praying you wouldn't call back, Allport said.
I found this cash register receipt. Lucas explained, and Allport said,
with the thing about the Tampax and the cat litter, it don't sound like she was taking food to a shut-in.
No, she needed the stuff on this list.
God damn it, where'd the fucking groceries go? I'll talk to the guys who found the car. Why don't you stay there for a few minutes? I'm going to run over and get that cash register tape.
Allport showed up a half hour later, shaking his head.
The guys who found the car said there was nothing in it, no groceries.
Hard to believe that somebody knocked her on the head for her groceries, Lucas said.
When Lucas got back to City Hall, Marcy Sherrill told him that the task force would meet the next day to get organized.
McGrady called. They think the hill's clean. They think they got all of them.
All right. I got two things.
Lucas told her about the wall at St. Pat's and the professor found in the river. Get the names of everybody in the St. Pat's art department and run them, and do a background on this professor who went over the dam.
Are you off again?
Nope. I've got to make a couple of phone calls.
Something just popped into my head.
He began by calling St. Paul Homicide and getting contact numbers for Charlotte Newman, the art professor. She had no local relatives, so he started with the department secretary. After identifying himself, he asked, "Did Ms. Newman have any expensive jewelry?"
A few pieces. She was a widow, you know.
No, I didn't.
Oh, yes. Her husband was quite a bit older, a very well-known architect in Rochester. She had a nice diamond engagement ring, and her wedding ring was gold, of course.
Lucas made a note of all the jewelry the secretary remembered Newman wearing.
Listen, thank you. You've really helped a lot.
Lucas hung up and redialed St. Paul Homicide.
Hey, when you guys went through Newman's house, did you inventory the valuables?
Sure.
Want me to shoot you the list? There's not much on it.
Lucas felt the tingle.
You have it? The list?
Yeah, just a minute.
The phone clunked on Allport's desk. He was back in a minute.
She didn't accumulate a lot.
Her secretary told me she wore an older gold Rolex watch, had a diamond engagement ring with a big diamond, maybe a carat and a half, pearls, a green stone ring that might have been an emerald, and diamond and sapphire earrings. Big sapphires. Very expensive.
Long silence.
You're really busting my balls, man.
None of it's on the list?
No.
What do you think?
I think I'm going to wind up working overtime.
Lucas leaned toward his door and yelled, Marcy!
What?
Do you have the number for Aronson's folks?
She dug it out and brought it in.
What's going on?
Tell you in a minute.
She sat down and Lucas dialed the number. Aronson's mother asked quietly,
Did you catch him?
Not yet.
I'm praying for it.
Mrs. Aronson, did your daughter have anything expensive, especially jewelry, or anything small and high value like that that might be missing?
Yes. We talked to somebody there about it, but we never found out what happened to it.
We think that the man who killed her may have taken the jewelry.
Oh, no.
But if he did, and we can identify it...
Oh, yes, I'd know these two pieces anywhere. An antique pearl necklace and an antique pearl wedding ring. They were my mother's, and her mother's before that.
Do you have any photos or anything?
Actually, my insurance agent does. Shall I send them?
What I would prefer is color copies. Hang on to the originals.
I will make copies and send them to you by express mail.
When he got off the phone, he told Marcy, We need a list of fences.
I'll talk to the guys in property crime.
You like this? Running things?
Yes. Not only that, I'm pretty good at it.
I thought you might be. I just hope you don't wind up spending too much time with this task force. Get your name known, but hang around here, not with them. It's always better to be with the winner.
The winner?
Yeah. The task force won't catch this guy.
We will.
Marcy had photos of Aronson's jewelry when Lucas arrived at the office in the morning, as well as insurance photographs of Newman's diamond and emerald rings. Lucas looked at the photos. Get the property guys to run these around town. Paper the place.
That's sorta underway. And McGrady called. They've got an ID on another one of the dead women.
Elise Hampton, from Clear Lake, Iowa. She disappeared 4 years ago, 28. She was unemployed and living with her parents when she disappeared. She'd been working with an insurance company in Des Moines in the advertising and publicity department. She'd been looking for work in both Des Moines and Minneapolis. Blonde, good-looking, small and busty. Divorced. Ex-husband was a cop in Mason City, and he's in the clear.
Another artsy type.
I called down to Clear Lake, but they've got nothing at all. She vanished, and her parents didn't even know where she'd been planning to go that day.
Is there any point in doing a list?
From what the Clear Lake cop said, her parents really didn't know too much about her friends either in Des Moines or up here.
God damn it.
He's careful about that. He cuts the women out of her usual crowd, moves in, must feed him some kind of bullshit to keep him from talking, and then kills him.
Maybe tells them he's married or something, Lucas said.
Still, you'd think.
Yeah, somebody would know.
They thought about that for a minute, then Marcy said, So anyway, that's three people we've ID'd from the graveyard, five to go.
With nothing specific to work on, Lucas had to decide whether to drive down to the graveyard or review paper. He noticed a shaft of sunlight out on the street. The sunlight made the decision for him. He was out of downtown ahead of the rush, running through the sun-dappled countryside. On the graveside hill, McGrady was sitting on a camp chair.
Still eight bodies? Lucas said.
Yeah, still eight. Another day out here, I think. If we don't find anything new.
You've still got TV.
Yep, but they're getting bored.
Lucas looked up the hill and saw Marshall sitting at the top.
But you still got Marshall.
The guy spooks the hell out of me. Good guy, but a little intense.
They talked for a few more minutes, then Lucas walked up the hill to where Marshall was sitting.
How's it going?
Marshall was smoking a Marlboro. He grinned and blew smoke.
Getting a handle on it. I got a little overworked there for a while. How's it going on your end?
He sounded so mellow that Lucas couldn't help smiling back.
We reviewed the cases we knew about and decided that our guy is stealing everything he can from the women he kills. Everything small and worthwhile, anyway. Jewelry, cash. We've got photos of stuff that was taken from Aronson, and maybe another woman, and we're going to run them around to every fence in town.
Marshall bobbed his head.
I'm starting to worry about what happens when we identify him.
Well, that could be a while yet.
I know the kind of work you guys do, that you do, and I think that sooner or later you're going to figure him out. Am I right?
Lucas shrugged.
I believe we will. I think we'll pin him with those drawings. Once we get a name, we can start connecting some dots, and we've got a lot of dots to start with. But what you'll get will be circumstantial. He could beat it.
That's always a risk.
Marshall blew more smoke, and his jaw worked. That would be tragic.
I don't think it'll happen.
So tell me what you got. I keep meaning to come up to see you, but I can't get myself away from...
He looked down the hill.
All the holes.
Lucas ran the case past him. Marshall's eyebrows went up when he heard about the photo of Laura Winton at St. Pat's, and about the death of Newman.
You think they're all connected?
We know he was at St. Pat's. We know the art teacher died after the drawings were put on TV. We know that Aronson was missing jewelry, and so was Newman. That's what we think. The St. Paul cops haven't gone public with it, but I think Newman was killed as a kind of cleanup. She figured something out.
A cleanup.
Marshall pitched his cigarette down the hill.
The fucker ought to be skinned alive.
Lucas's cell phone rang, and he fumbled it out of his pocket.
Yeah? This is Dell. Where are you?
Down at the graveyard.
We got a break. Get your ass back up here.
Lucas said, I'm on my way. Hung up, and to Marshall, gotta run.
Something?
Maybe.
Marshall said, I'm coming.
And they both scrambled down the wet hill.
Lucas was Porsche trained and showed it. Even in the hippo-like Tahoe, he could see Marshall laboring to keep up.
Lucas led him into a parking garage downtown, called Dell while the other cop parked, and after Marshall had climbed into the Tahoe, continued out. Dell was waiting on the corner at City Hall.
Tell Terry what you told me, Lucas said, as Dell climbed in the back.
I was running a picture of Newman's and Aronson's jewelry around town. There's a guy Lucas and I both know. Bob Brown's his name. He deals in estate jewelry. Tries to keep it as legit as he can. I showed him the pictures, and as soon as he saw the Aronson ring and the pearl necklace, he recognized them. They came in 6 months ago. He'd sold the necklace, but the ring was still there, and it's got the love forever. I gave him a receipt. It's back at the office.
Lucas said to Marshall, the ring had love forever engraved inside.
So there's no question then, Marshall said. Where'd he get them?
Off a bartender named Frank Stans at the Bolo Lounge, a nudie bar out on Highway 55. Stans told him he bought the stuff across the bar from a guy who said he inherited it.
What are the chances that Stans...
Stans is a black guy, and he's dealt with Bob on other stuff, so it's unlikely, Dell said.
And we know where he's at, this Stans guy?
Marshall said.
Dell looked at his watch.
His shift started about 10 minutes ago.
The Bolo Lounge was open but had no customers. Frank Stans was older, in his 60s, Lucas thought, bald with a fringe of white hair. He looked like he'd once lifted a lot of weight, and from time to time, some of it had fallen on his face.
Mr. Stans, Lucas asked.
Who wants to know?
Minneapolis police.
Lucas showed him his ID and pulled the photos of the Aronson jewelry out of his pocket.
We're told that you sold this ring and necklace to Bob Brown 6 months ago. We're wondering where you got it.
Don't remember.
It'd be really good if you tried hard, Dell said. The stuff was taken off a girl who was murdered. We're not looking at you as an accomplice, Lucas said.
Not yet, said Marshall.
Lucas glanced at him. Marshall's voice sounded like chipped glass. Then looked back at Stans and said, So look at him again. Stans and Marshall had locked eyes, and neither was backing off. Dell said, This is particularly important to the deputy here, 'cause some of his family was killed by the guy who took this jewelry. Stans looked back down at the pictures and said,
Yeah, I got it off some white boy. Never saw him before. Said somebody told him that I bought estate jewelry.
What'd he look like? Lucas asked. Stan shrugged.
I don't know. Like a white boy. Skinny, maybe 6 feet. Maybe blonde hair. Doper. He was running on crack. He wanted the money right that minute. I had $300 on me. I told him take it or leave it, and he took it.
Would you recognize him if you saw him again? Stans nodded.
If he introduced himself, I'd remember.
Lucas thanked him, and they headed for the door. Outside, a little pissed, he said to Marshall, That wasn't real cool, the way you jumped in there with the threats.
Just being the asshole, Marshall said mildly. Didn't mean nothing by it. And we got what we came for.
You sounded like you meant it, Lucas said.
I'm good at that.
Very good at it, Lucas thought. They were in the truck when Stans appeared at the door and pointed at Lucas. Lucas ran the window down and said, What?
I remember one other thing about this white boy.
Yeah?
He talked like a brother. I mean, you always running into white boys who see you're black and so they talk a little black. That's just bullshit. Fucking bigots. This boy, he talked like a brother like he didn't even know he was doing it. Sounded to me like he grew up in one of the projects.
Did he look like he might have had a couple of fights? Fucked up eyebrows, maybe a little loose in the nose?
Yeah. You know him? What happened to him?
I happened to him. It's that fucking Randy Whitcomb, the fancy man.
You know him?
Marshall asked. Lucas nodded. Yeah.
You think he could?
Lucas shrugged. Randy could do almost anything. He's a fucking pimp, and we know he beats the shit out of his girls from time to time, and he probably has killed somebody.
Crazy motherfucker, Dell agreed.
But, yeah, not really his style. The guy we're looking for is nuts. But he's under control, deliberate. Randy's completely out of control. The other thing is, he would have been too young when your niece was taken. Randy's still got to be in his early 20s, 21, 22.
So maybe he was just passing the jewelry along.
If he only took 300 for it, then he probably got it for free, or the next thing to it. If Randy didn't do it, the guy who gave him the jewelry knows who did.
So we look up this Randy. Marshall said comfortably. We find him. We're right there.
Gotta find him, Lucas said. He's a key.
Somebody's gotta find him, Dell said. Not you.
Lucas nodded. Marshall picked up the interplay.
What happened?
I once arrested Randy a little too, enthusiastically. It created a situation.
Dell snorted. Shit. It got your ass fired. Randy looked like a carpet that had been beat with an axe.
But you're back, said Marshall. You got unfired.
Just about took an act of God, Dell said. But I'll get him. I'll look up some of his pals tonight.
I'm coming, said Marshall. Dell nodded. Okay, you can watch. Gonna catch us a fancy man. Randy Whitcomb, his clothes aside, resembled a photograph of a Civil War soldier. Pale, raw-boned, crooked teeth, the skin of his face touched with pox, the result of an early and violent encounter with acne. He looked like a mean white hillbilly. He didn't let that stop him. Randy Whitcomb was a fancy man.
He liked blackthorn walking sticks with gold nugget heads, big broad-brimmed llama felt hats, gold chains, and red sport coats. Randy thought he was a black pimp, though he was, in fact, a white boy from the suburbs of Minneapolis. His background didn't keep him from talking ghetto black. Randy was 22, but looked 44. Randy sold dope, ran an occasional whore, and was James Qatar's fence. Through some process that Qatar didn't totally understand, Randy would exchange jewelry and other high-value stolen goods, handguns mostly, for dope out of Chicago. He would peddle some of the dope and eat the rest. The stolen jewelry sold in Chicago for half of what it was worth, Randy said, and the Chicago people only gave Randy half of what they could get for it. So Randy could only give Qatar half of what he could get, an eighth of the real value. But that was crime, Qatar thought. Qatar had met Randy through a hip marketing professor who did a little cocaine. What Qatar didn't know was that Randy didn't have a fencing connection in Chicago. He sold it on the street in Minneapolis to whoever would take it. What Qatar didn't know wouldn't hurt him, Randy thought. Qatar had called Randy's beeper in the afternoon and had gotten an address in St. Paul on Selby. He wouldn't be home until late, Randy said, after midnight. Qatar looked at his watch when he arrived outside Randy's. 12:10. Randy lived in a yuppie-looking townhouse, gray and white. The place was not what Qatar expected. But Randy answered the door.
Who'd fuck are you?
Randy, I called.
Shit, you called. What'd you call about?
Randy's eyes seemed fogged. Qatar backed away. I've got some jewelry. The fog seemed to lift an inch.
Jim, he said. You Jim.
I better go. You look like you need some sleep. Randy suddenly laughed.
Don't need no sleep. I don't need no sleep. You saying I need sleep? Come on in.
Randy caught Qatar's arm. His hand felt like a mechanical claw. Qatar was dragged along, afraid to protest, into the townhouse and up a flight of stairs. Randy shouted,
Hey, bitch, get out here!
A minute later, a too thin blonde girl padded out of a back hallway. She might have been 16, Qatar thought. She was round-shouldered with defeat.
I just had to pee, Randy. Yeah, well, get me and my friend a beer and make it fucking quick.
You want it in glasses?
Of course we want it in fucking glasses, and they best be clean.
He said to Qatar,
I ain't got her fully broke yet.
Qatar nodded. I've got some stuff for you.
Let's see it, Jim.
Qatar handed him the little bag of jewelry, and Randy shook it out into his hand.
What's it worth?
I've been checking the jewelry stores. I should get 3,000. You should get 6 from Chicago. Both the diamond and the emerald are real.
Okay, I got no cash right now. I'll get it to you day after tomorrow.
He put the jewelry back in the bag, slipped the bag into his pocket. The woman came out of the kitchen with 2 glasses of beer. Randy and Qatar both had a sip of beer, and then Randy said,
You got any cash on you?
Qatar's eyebrows went up. $50, maybe.
Got a cash card?
Well,
what's your limit?
400, Qatar said, mentally kicking himself the moment the words were out of his mouth.
I tell you what happened. I started partying and I run out of cash. So I went to a cash machine and I partied some more, and then I run out of cash again. And I was at my daily limit. I just gotta wait until tomorrow before my cash card works again.
Huh, Qatar said.
So I ain't asking for a loan. I want to sell you something.
What? I mean, I really don't need...
Her,
Randy said, nodding at the woman on the floor. I don't fool around with prostitutes. I mean, I worry about AIDS and syphilis and gonorrhea and herpes. Randy put a hand to his chest, offended.
Randy ain't gonna give you the clap, man. You ain't gonna get the clap sticking your dick down her throat.
Well, I... Qatar looked at the woman again. She was his type, although a little dirty-looking. The thing was, Barstad was wearing him out.
He hadn't had a random sexual thought in days.
She'd do anything you want, Dick. Anything.
Man, I appreciate it. Randy couldn't believe he was being turned down. He turned to the woman.
Stand up, bitch. Take off the clothes and show the man what you got.
The woman stood up and started shedding her clothes. All her pubic hair had been shaved off, and Qatar noticed that she was developing a rash. Something about that, the rash, stirred him. She seemed so helpless, unformed.
She'd do anything,
Randy said again. I'll make you a deal. If you give me $5,000 for the jewelry, plus my $400 back, $5,400 total next week, I'll get the money out of the machine right now. Randy laughed.
You got it, Dick. You got it. You get it in 2 days, soon as the delivery boy comes from St. Louis.
St. Louis? They looked at each other for a moment. Then Qatar shrugged. No, all right.
Yes!
Randy shouted, pumping a fist. Can I come with? The woman asked.
Shut the fuck up! Randy screamed. You can't go outside until you got a name, bitch, and you ain't got one.
To Qatar.
I ain't figured her name out yet.
Okay, so...
So let's go, Dick.
Qatar was now Dick, because Randy had used Dick in a sentence. He wasn't sure, but looking at Randy leaning against the passenger side window, blubbering to himself, he was very sure that Randy had gone over some unseen edge. They went to a cash machine at a branch bank on Grand Avenue. Qatar took out $400. Randy's brain was missing a few links, Qatar thought. Even so, he knew where he was going. In 5 minutes, they were idling in front of an apartment. Randy hopped out and said, perfectly rationally,
You can come in if you like, but they're mostly brothers. They don't like white boys that good.
That's okay, I gotta get home anyway. Qatar rolled away from the apartment. The car seemed all by itself to roll back to Randy's place. He'd been thinking about the woman since they left the apartment. Not the possibility of sex, but the other possibility. Randy's brain was fried. He wouldn't remember this. Qatar went to the door and rang. The blonde had gotten dressed again. Qatar said, Randy talked me into giving him $500, but he said I get you any way I want. The blonde looked past him, unsure. Where's Randy? He's back at the apartment partying. When we're done, I'm supposed to take you over there. A misstep. Now she was suspicious. I can't go outside till I got a name. He thought of a name, Qatar improvised. You've got a name.
I do. What is it?
Tiffany. Like the jewelry store.
Tiffany. That's pretty good. Tiffany. Okay. Come on in.
She was a hooker, and it didn't take long. He got her on her hands and knees in front of the couch, waiting for him to enter her. He'd rolled the condom down, positioned himself behind her. His pants had been tossed on the couch, and he fished the rope out of the back pocket, touched her back with it, trailed it down her spine. She asked, What's that? And turned her head. Nothing, nothing, keep going. Formed his loop, touched her neck again, held the loop open, smiled, dropped it around her neck, and snap! He tightened it like a hangman's noose and pressed her down with his weight. He half stood, held her suspended above the floor, held her and shook her, and watched her hands flailing, watched them weaken, felt the power surging through his arms into his heart. As her struggles slowed and weakened, he straddled her and lowered her to the floor, her hands scratching along the furry carpet. He knelt over her. At the end, she arched her back, and her hands fluttered in a terminal dog paddle, and she died. God, that felt good. When she stopped the shuddering that came with brain death, Qatar released his grip, then rolled her over. Her eyes were open, staring sightlessly up at the ceiling, her mouth touched with blood, and a puddle of blood pooled on the rug beneath her neck.
After a minute with her, he sighed. Gotta get going. He got dressed, flushed the condom, surprised to find it full of semen. He didn't remember that part. Got a chunk of toilet paper and walked through the apartment, wiping everything he could remember touching. Another flush, and he was done. Thank God for toilets. Money. There wouldn't be any cash, but there should be something. Qatar walked through the apartment looking, and found nothing small. Randy had apparently sold everything that could be peddled on the street. Moron, he said aloud. He stepped over the woman's body on the way out. Queen for a day. Tiffany for a minute. Nice tits, though. Randy got back at dawn and pounded on the door, because he didn't want to go through the whole business of finding his key. He was not in any shape to find it, so he beat on the door until somebody shouted, "Go away or we'll call the police!" He didn't need the police, so he took 5 minutes and finally found the key. Climbed the stairs in the dark. There was no switch at the entrance, but he was too fucked up to use it. And in the living room, in the dark, tripped over the woman's body. Fucking... He groped around on the floor, felt a breast, knew what it was, and knew it was too cold. Randy started down, the cocaine strength dissipating like a fart in a thunderstorm. He crawled across the floor to a lamp, turned it on. Looked down at what's-her-name. What had he done? He pressed his hands to his temple, trying to squeeze out the memories that must be there somewhere. When had he done it? Motherfucker. Weather had spent the night at her own place. If we haven't rung the bell yet, I don't think we'll get it done this month, she'd said. Plus, my house is getting stale. I need to air it out. Lucas didn't remember that when he woke up. Still drowsy, he reached out for her, came quickly awake looking for her. Remembered the question he'd asked the night before. Pregnant? Not pregnant? When would they know? In the by and by, she'd said. It was fun working with you, Davenport. Maybe we can do it again next month. Then again, maybe we won't have to. He half smiled at the thought and drifted off again. Lucas liked to stay up late, but didn't like early mornings. A good day, he believed, generally started around 10 o'clock. 10 o'clock was just coming up when the phone rang and continued to ring. He recognized Dell's style.
Yeah.
Randy's around, but I can't find him. He was running a hooker named Charmin until a couple of weeks ago, but...
Charmin? Like the toilet paper?
That's what they say. Anyway, he wandered off in a cocaine blizzard, and she transferred to DDT, and that's where she's still at. Thing is, I can't find DDT. I got a couple of people looking for him, and also for Randy.
You want me to come along if you find DDT?
If you don't mind. He owes you big, and you don't owe me shit.
Give me a call.
Lucas shaved. He got dressed, looked out the window. Patches of blue sky. And loaded into the Porsche. He was whistling when he pushed into the office. Marcy was talking on the phone. Lucas paused and looked her over. Marcy tended to be a little too tense all the time, and when the tension was suddenly relieved, it showed. Lucas continued into his office, a little pissed now. That goddamn kid had gotten into her pants. He knew the look too well to be mistaken.
God damn it, he said. If Kit and Marcy, I didn't want to think about it. But it sure as hell was going to reduce her efficiency at a critical moment in the case, and...
I don't want to hear the first fucking word from you. Marcy was in the doorway. I just, not the first fucking word. When he opened his mouth again, she said, "No, bad dog." Lucas dropped into his chair. "You don't know him that well."
"Shut up, mister. Why don't we screw Marcy Sherrill on the office carpet?"
"We knew each other for a long time. That was spontaneous."
"So was last night. And I tell you what, he's a good guy."
A moment later, Dell came in, with Marshall trailing behind.
"We found DDT.
DDT stood for Dangerous Daryl Thomas. Thomas had given himself the name when he was riding with a motorcycle club
and was interviewed for a public radio magazine. Darryl wasn't much of a pimp. His only pimping qualification was that he liked to fight, and when a girl wanted to leave her former sponsor or was having trouble with a customer who expected fidelity, she might move in with Darryl. He would grudgingly take care of her, and if she wanted to chip in a few bucks every once in a while and maybe clean house and cook a few meals, that was okay. And if she didn't, that was okay too. They tended to drift away when they discovered that Darryl really didn't care. At all. About anything. Except cars. Darryl was a professional house sitter. "Can't believe he got a gig in Edina," Lucas said as they pulled into his driveway. The house was long and white and two-storied with faux marble pillars. "Wonder what the neighbors think about the horrors going in and out. Maybe they think it's colorful." Dell leaned on the doorbell, and a woman with power-frizzed hair stuck her head out and snarled,
"What?"
"We're friends of DDT. Is he home?"
"Yeah, but he's in the spa. It's outside on the deck," the woman said, pointing.
Dell and Lucas walked over to the French doors at the end of the living room and stepped out onto a deck. The spa was big enough to seat 8, but in this case sat 3. DDT, a large, balding, and mildly fat man who was reading the New York Times, and 2 women, both with short, mousy brown hair. Steam rose out of the spa into the cold air, but they all seemed comfortable. None of them were wearing any clothing at all.
"Hey, Lucas, how they hanging, man?"
DDT said, looking up from the paper.
"Dell, you fuckhead, what's happening?"
To the girls, he said,
"They're cops."
"We got a problem, Darryl," Lucas said. "We're looking for a girl named, He looked at Dell. Dell said,
"Charmin."
DDT pointed at one of the mice, who said,
"Jesus Christ, it's Charmin. Like in charming, you asshole. It's not Charmin like the toilet paper."
Lucas said, "Charmin, you were working for Randy Whitcomb and we need to find him."
"What's he done?"
"Nothing. We're trying to figure out where he might have bought some jewelry."
"I don't know if I ought to talk to cops. Randy's a crazy motherfucker."
"Tell him," DDT said. She looked at him.
"You're supposed to be on my side."
"I owe him, big time. So you can tell him or move the fuck out." She looked at DDT for a minute, then at Lucas.
"He's in St. Paul, one of them gray apartments on Sibley. I don't know the number."
She gave them a few details and Lucas nodded. He knew exactly where she meant.
"Thanks." "You be careful. The crazy fucker's been smoking crack. He ain't got any brains left. And don't tell him where you got this."
DDT said, "So what are you driving?"
C4. Bought it new last year."
"Why don't you bring it around sometime?"
"I will. When it warms up a little, we'll take it out for a run."
On the way out of the house, Marshall said,
"That was pretty smooth. Why'd he owe you so big?"
"Last fall, I found him a 455 Olds engine. He was really hurting for one."
"You pulling my weenie?"
"No. I mean, it was absolutely cherry." Lucas called St. Paul from the car, got Allport, and filled him in on the jewelry and the connection to Randy Whitcomb. "We're on our way right now."
"Need some help?"
"We could use a warrant and somebody to block the back."
"Warrant's no problem. I'll get a couple of squads and come up myself,"
Allport said.
"What, half an hour, 45 minutes?
"About that." They agreed to meet 3 blocks from Randy's to coordinate. 6 St. Paul uniform guys arrived in 3 squads, including one guy who was the designated hammer. Allport looked around at his crew.
"Lucas and Dell and I have known this asshole ever since he came downtown. He can be bad news, so be careful. He's not that big, but he's crazy."
"We never found a gun on him," Lucas said, "but he's carried one from time to time. He's been doing a lot of crack, we hear. So if you gotta tackle him hard. Don't hurt him. We need him to talk to us." They were all starting to breathe hard, feeling the rush.
"Come in last," Dell told Lucas. "If there's no trouble, it won't make any difference. If there is trouble, maybe it won't rub off on you. But if there's big trouble, you'll be in position to lay some shit on him."
Lucas nodded.
Randy had been a new guy on the block when one of his girls had spent some time with Lucas talking. Randy had heard about it. He'd learned from the cheaper TV shows that the girl had to be taught a lesson for her disrespect. He'd taught her the lesson with a church key, cutting an average-looking hooker into a scholarly paper in a plastic surgery journal. Lucas and Dell had gone to arrest Randy at a bar, but everybody had known it would come to a fight, and it had. Randy had ended that particular day in Hennepin General's critical care unit. Lucas had left the department under a cloud of possible excessive force charges. He'd been back for a while, but Randy Whitcomb still could be a political problem. The hooker had left the streets and now worked at a Walmart. She didn't talk to Lucas anymore.